listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again F. William Engdahl. And I would like to tell you, suggest to all of my listeners that they go to williamengdahl.com. That's Engdahl spelled E-N-G-D-A-H-L, williamengdahl.com. Avail yourself there to William's very insightful essays. He writes very frequently. He's written a number of books that are extremely insightful and truthful, I believe, and very, very helpful. If you want to know what is really true, or at least have a different perspective from the constant 24/7 propaganda that we are being fed day in and day out here in America, and I suspect in the Western world in general. Thank you for joining me again, William.
Glad to be with you, Jay.
Always good to have you with me. You know, one question on my mind with regard to geopolitics and the struggle between Asia and, let's say, the East and the West has been this whole issue of which side is India on? And so I was very much intrigued by an article that you recently titled, Has Narendra Modi Switched Sides? And as an overview to your article, let me just read what you said at the top of that article. You said, and I quote, "It's very discomforting to see the nation of India, one of the great potential leading countries of the world, systematically self-destruct, provoking a new war with China over remote chunks of land in the high Himalayas where the borders of China and Tibet autonomous region converge with India and the Kingdom of Bhutan is only the latest example. The question posed is who or what grand design is behind India's foreign and domestic policies under Prime Minister Narendra Modi? Has Modi switched sides? If so, to whom?" So, you know, you noted in that article, William, that I think last year relations between India and China and even Pakistan and India seem to be improving. Can you talk a little bit about what seemed to be moving in a peaceful direction before some changes took place?
What seemed to be the case was, it was formalized this summer, actually, but last year the vote was taken by the members of the Eurasian Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a group of nations including Russia and China and several of the key countries in Central Asia, including Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan. And they voted to accept, after several years of observer status, both Pakistan and India into the SCO format as full members. Now, shortly after that admission, Modi began saber-rattling against China. And it's like a bully trying to pick fights, but India itself is in no military shape to take on China. So you have to ask the question, who's giving China the backbone to make these provocations? And the answer doesn't go much beyond Washington and the U.S. intelligence, CIA, and such characters. Very clearly, you want to cut China down to size in terms of its growing influence in the world as a stabilizing economic power, among other things, among the most alarming for the Wall Street gods of money, as I call them in my book.
Yeah, yeah.
Wall Street bankers that think they own the world because they print all the money for the world, or a lot of it. And they cannot tolerate a peaceful emergence of a counterweight to their sole superpower status. And that's very one-sided of them, I think. But nonetheless, that's their flawed reasoning about world power. So I think they're very much behind this Modi operation. as was, you remember last November, I think it was, that Modi announced that as of the end of the year, or a very short time frame, all Indian paper bills of a valuation that translates into about $8 US and $15 US, and these constituted 85% of the paper currency circulating in the Indian economy, they were going to be no longer valid, and unless Indians turned them into a bank and get a bank account with digital credit in return, they were out of luck. And that would mean an 85% shrinkage of the money in circulation in the Indian economy. Now, India's economy is not the same as Germany's economy, where I live right now. India's economy is primarily an informal economy of very hand-to-mouth business transactions by small shopkeepers and others to simply feed themselves. And a tiny percent of the Indian population is upper middle class, university educated, IT programmers, or what will you. And for the most part, India is still a third world nation in terms of the most of the population. So what Modi did by doing this, and it was done on the instructions of the Reserve Bank of India, the central bank, was catastrophic for the Indian economy, and later parliament reports demonstrated that. So one has to ask, what is Modi doing? Is he a sadist against his own people, and then provoking a potential war with China, mm-hmm. rather than a peaceful cooperation? And the argument of India is that China has invested some $60 billion in something called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, part of the so-called New Silk Road, or the One Bridge, One Road mm-hmm. massive infrastructure project of China that is, to my mind, the most important physical construction economic project in the history of the last 500 years on this earth, mm-hmm. and has the potential to transform the world economy, not just the Chinese economy. This is much bigger than China. And if we in the West were to embrace that in an open and honest way, this would be the way out of continuous wars of destruction and so forth to processes of building up, building infrastructure, something America urgently needs, especially now after this absolute catastrophe in Texas with the catastrophic rains and Hurricane Harvey in the last days, and it's by no means over. Mm-hmm. So infrastructure is the byword of the future of not only the world economy, but the U.S. economy. So India, by going into a military provocation in this remote, remote place of the Himalayas, near Bhutan, the kingdom of Bhutan, where China, India, and Bhutan all meet their borders, mm-hmm. Leads me to ask, whose side is Modi playing on? I have a good Indian dialogue partner, let's say. She's a professor of law at a leading Indian university. Her husband was one of the most senior members of the Indian military until about, I think it was 10 or 12 years ago, when he was too outspoken against one of the corrupt prime ministers and, as a result, lost his job. And she says that the tragedy is that Modi has never been anything but the marionette of the Indian oligarchs who are beholden to the U.S. or the Anglo-American oligarchs around groups like the Bilderberg or the Trilateral Commission or so forth, even though India is not, to my knowledge, a member of the Trilateral yet. Mm-hmm. And they destroy India much as the British destroyed India during the colonial period, the East India Company, the British government. But Modi is doing that to his own people. So this is a very dangerous development, I think, in terms of world peace.
Yeah. Well, William, you know, trying to understand it from, you know, from our policymakers' point of view or our ruling elite's point of view, the dollar, which I think is an illegitimate currency, it's a currency that's been forced on the world when Bretton Woods was pulled apart, especially in 1971. That was the end of any sort of notion of an honest dollar, because it was no longer based on on real value. It was based on the might of the United States and the military-industrial complex. Just thinking through what you're saying now, if the rest of the world, let's say, because India is such a large population combined with China, and then Russia's raw materials, as you've talked about in the past, being such an important part of the New Silk Road, that that there must be some people in our military-industrial complex that are saying, holy cow, this cannot go on, because if this monstrous economy of Asia and all the way up into Europe is successful, and they have their own currencies, and indeed those countries are not looking to use dollars anymore, they're trying to get rid of their dollars, they're using their own currencies to trade amongst themselves, they're using gold too, from what I understand, and all those those countries are really building their gold reserves. India, as much as any, the people have a love for gold. They put their savings in gold. That's what they trust. So, I've wondered, you know, I mean, the policy from Modi has been to try to discourage people from owning gold. He's put taxes and various things to try to keep them from owning gold. It seems to me that if the CIA is involved in trying to change things there, it makes a lot of sense, not on the part of the American people who have no clue that this is going on, but it makes a lot of sense from the point of view of a very small ruling elite that want to dominate the global economy and indeed probably put into effect a one-world government with Washington or some elitist somewhere in charge of it, right? Isn't that what's going on here? Divide and conquer. Get rid of India. Don't allow that monstrous country of over a billion people to be a part of this. Let's pull them over to our side. At least let's destroy them so they can't be a part of it.
Well, I think it's not even quite that yet. It's let's use India as a battering ram to beat up China and to destroy the Silk Road project by creating a war, provoking China and creating a war. Now, I've been to China something like I've lost count, but 16 times in the last 8 years. The latest was in June. And I made a tour of China in terms of researching a new book project on the Silk Road and what that really means in terms of real ports, in terms of real high-speed rail connections throughout Eurasia and throughout into Europe and also into Southeast Asia. And the Chinese are, if you look at their diplomatic record over the last 40, 50 years, they are not going around the world to provoke fights. The situation, the conflicts with India in 1962 and others in the past, and the situation in Tibet, was being provoked by the CIA. That's well documented in 1959 with the Dalai Lama. The CIA smuggled the Dalai Lama out of Tibet and put him into a safe house set up in India across the border. And, of course, that created a strong friction point between the Chinese government and India. But China is not inclined to be hot-headed. They sometimes, the British intelligence has profiled the Indian ideology and psychology and the Chinese psychology very, very deeply. Look at what the Opium Wars were with the British after 1840, lasting up until Chiang Kai-shek, by the way, in 1949, when the Chinese Revolution forced Chiang Kai-shek into exile in Taiwan. So the the British and less so the Americans, because they're not as deeply steeped in study of history and culture, but there are enough experts that are hired from Britain in American universities and government agencies as consultants. They know the flashpoints, and they're trying to provoke these with China. And I'll give you an interesting example of how the sophistication of the Chinese leadership has changed over even the last 8 years. My first trip to China was in April of 2008, 2 months or 3 months before the Summer Olympics, the Beijing Olympics. And I'm sorry, are we still on?
Yes, we're here. Yeah,
okay, I got a message here. And at that point, there were riots in Tibet being provoked by the U.S. Soft power NGOs like National Endowment for Democracy, Freedom mm-hmm. House, etc., to embarrass the Chinese before this grand Olympics that they were so proud of, that they were presenting themselves to the world as an emerging modern nation, mm-hmm. which they certainly are. And their response, their immediate response, was the articles, editorials in the China Daily with terminology like the Dalai Lama, the capitalist running dog lackey of imperialism, mm-hmm. blah, 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 is really yeah. nonsense. But yeah. this is old ideology from the 1950s, of course.
Yeah.
And now, in 2014, I think it was, there was a Hong Kong umbrella revolution where students occupied the main business center of Hong Kong.
Sure.
And was causing all sorts of problems and protesting Beijing's ruling of Hong Kong, which was turned over to China in 1999 under certain conditions by the British. And I wrote several articles in public domain that detailed how the National Endowment for Democracy and CIA-controlled NGOs of Washington, so-called human rights NGOs, were running this to embarrass China on the Hong Kong question. And about 2 weeks later, I'm not saying there's a direct cause and effect, but about 2 weeks later, China Daily had an editorial, and the lead title was, "Why is Washington always making color revolutions?"
Yes.
And text led with the name of the vice president of the National Endowment for Democracy, responsible for the China portfolio and their meetings with key leadership in the mm-hmm. Hong Kong color revolution.
Sure.
So this reflects a very, very rapid sophistication of the Chinese leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They, they're learning very quickly. They've been isolated for decades. And
yeah.
Now they're in the larger world and learning what the games are of Washington and Britain and so forth. So I don't think they're going to preemptively get suckered in, just as they haven't yet in the East or South China Sea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, certainly they would like to have access to the South China Sea and believe they should have some dominion over it. And why should the United States, I guess? And you can understand that thinking, although I don't think most Americans can. We've been so programmed to think that we should rule the world for the good of everybody else.
Yeah, well, it's not good. We've spent more than $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Think of what $1 trillion could do in the damaged parts of the Texas Gulf of Mexico coast after this catastrophe.
Yeah. Well, or countless other needs,
In Afghanistan since Bush 2001, September, October. Yeah. $1 trillion on a war in Afghanistan for what? For what?
Well, I think President Eisenhower...
Good for America.
I believe President Eisenhower warned us about that as he was leaving office. The military-industrial complex, it has a life of its own. And honestly, William, it seems to me that nobody is really in charge. This is some sort of a major monster that is just moving forward without... It's certainly the President of the United States, whoever he or she is not in charge. I think you would agree with that.
I would certainly agree with that, yeah.
I mean, just look at Kennedy and, maybe the last person to really challenge the military-industrial complex, some people believe... and we know what message was sent to future presidents after that. William, with one minute left, closing thoughts on this issue about India?
Yes. Closing thoughts about India is, India is at a crossroads right now. The Modi policies are destroying any potential of peaceful development of the whole Indian subcontinent. Either there's a possibility that Modi makes a road to Damascus shift, which I don't foresee, or there's a rejection of the Modi policies by layers of the Indian elites or the Indian leading circles, and a change of leadership.
All right.
In either case, if they continue down this road, it's going to mean the destruction of India.
Well, we do have to leave it go at that. William, thank you so much for being with us. It's very important to folks to read what William says about these issues, many others. Very important information that you don't get from our mainstream media. Thank you so much, William, for being with us, and we'll look forward to doing it again in the near future.
Thank you, folks. That
is all the time we have today. Next week, John Rubino will be with me, hopefully Michael Oliver as well. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.